Well, this technique is not my own. Our daughter, when she was four, we had just adopted her in that summer. We found a Bible school, as a lot of parents do, real quickly. We found the Church of Christ had one down the street. And so she went, and that night she came back, and we asked her, you know, what did you learn? And she just rattled off the commandments. And I was like, okay, good. So I just wanted to show you, it's a little trick, but what I think is it may help you. In the next 3 weeks, I'll see if you all can remember it. But you'll probably remember a couple of them even today. So it's great for kids, too, but adults also. So what is the first one? Okay. And, I'm going to put the one just for that. Kind of there's one God. No, and just the one God. If you remember that, you're in good shape. The second one is a little two over on its side. And what is the second commandment? Not to bow down before any images. So this is a little person bowing down. So this one I couldn't remember. So I think I kind of did this. What's the third one? Okay. And this is going to be, this one I just can't remember. So I think I'd made this like a V on its side and would just ignore this. And so that's for vain. I'll put that. Don't take the Lord's name in vain. All right. What about the fourth one? Oh, y'all are doing great. Okay. You just make a four, that kind of old-fashioned four. And you do another one. And you kind of connect them. And it makes a little pew. So you'll remember it. I mean, this is for your 4 to 5 year old, but you're going to remember it. Okay. The last one just had kind of a crown over it. What's the fifth commandment? Okay, so it's just kind of, they have a crown to honor, in sense of honor. So if you remember, that one doesn't really have a real connection, but all right. What about the sixth one? Okay, and this is a little six on its side, and it's like a little gun. Okay. The Church of Christ knows what works here. Okay, the seventh one, what is it? It's what we're doing today. Okay, and that's just a little seven, and that's the A. It's a little A. A for adultery. All right, now here's kind of a cute one. What's the eighth command? Okay, and this is a little eight that's a cookie jar. So you're not to steal from the cookie jar, okay? And then the ninth one, what's the ninth commandment? This is really tough. We haven't studied these, so this isn't fair, but good. So this is a little gavel for you little lawyers out there. This is a gavel, bang, bang, bang. So you don't make a false witness in court. Okay. All right, here's the last one. What's the last command for us? Okay, so now this one you gotta have an imagination too. This is a person, and they're looking out through a window, and they're wanting everything outside that window that they're seeing, they're coveting. So just think of a little person. I don't know what would make a little person, but that's a little person. All right, now. All right, let me ask you, I'm going to take this because, all right, so what would be the first one? One God. Okay, how about three? All right, don't take the Lord's name, baby. How about two? Two on its side. Yeah, not to bow down. How about five? Had a little crown. Okay, how about four? Little pew. It's a, okay. How about eight? It's a little, okay. So you do not steal. How about a 10, that little figure? Don't covet. How about nine? Yeah, don't bear false witness in court. How about six, the little six over on the side? Yeah, no murder. And seven? Oh, see, you're going to remember these. Next week, I bet you can number them all. But isn't it a great little trick? All right, so we'll work on it next week, too.
I'm good. I've been replaced. Well, we're about to redo this whole room anyway, so we're good. Nobody tell the powers that be that there's ink on the wall. Good. Well, good morning. Did you enjoy that? It's kind of fun. The one that our daughter really needed was the cookie jar one. She was big on cookie jars. Okay. Today we start in the seventh commandment. It is everybody's favorite, right? Adultery. You remember all the jokes they used to have about Moses coming down the mountain, he's got 15 commandments, he stumbles and falls, one breaks, there's 10. Another joke is Moses comes down and he says, I got good news and bad news. Have you heard that one? Okay, remember the 15 commandments? The good news is I got him down to 10. Bad news is adultery is still in. Okay, so Exodus 20:14, no surprises here, are there? You shall not commit adultery. Deuteronomy is the other version of it. Neither shall you commit adultery. Just a slight word change. This is one of those commandments that what really stands out about it is how simple, straightforward, and direct it is. No ifs, no ands, no buts, no sort of nibbling around the edges. Two ways that you can see this. One is this, the language that's used. When you go back and plow into what was the word used in Hebrew, what is the word used in Greek when Jesus is referring to this. In Hebrew, it is na'ap, and in Greek, it's mocheo, and both of those words mean exactly what you would think they would mean. Some of the other commandments, sometimes the word has multiple meanings and stuff. This time, we don't get that. It's very much straightforward, exactly what you think it would be. Nothing in the language that would let you off the hook, that it might mean something else or, you know, those kind of conditions and stuff. So, for the last 4,000 years, or 3,000 years, it has not changed. Second, it's striking that there's no motivational clause, there's no carrot. No promise, if you do this, you will get something out of it. Just the commandment laid out there. Just the don't do it. End of story, and we now finish the world's shortest kerygma lesson. Okay, that's okay, we can. Questions? All right. You know that's not going to happen. Context matters, right? So we want to today kind of play with context, both in terms of the ancient world and how this is sort of played out over the centuries and even today. And one of the things we're going to look at is the wedding service that we have, both the traditional wedding service and the contemporary wedding service, and including some changes in that. So, seventh commandment came out of a very different world. In particular, the way women were viewed. Were very, very different. No surprise to you that women were considered property, right? You know that's in Scripture. That's the view, that's the worldview that was kind of there. For example, you were property of your father until what happened? What did we do in the wedding service? The father gave the bride. And in ancient times, that was very literal. So, for example, a book of Tobit, which is written shortly before the time of Jesus, reflects the New Testament period. Then he called her mother and told her to bring writing material. He wrote out a copy of the marriage contract. So it's a legally binding contract between two families to the effect that he gave her to him as a wife according to the decree of the law of Moses. So broader context there is that we're working within the marriage understanding here. Women were property. Sirach, another writing from about the same time, give a daughter in marriage. This is advice to particularly young men who are leaders in the community. This is what a father should do. Give a daughter in marriage and you complete a great task. So one of the jobs of a father is to make sure that his daughter is secured into a marriage. That's his task. It lingers in the day in wedding services. The father gives it, but you know that's not in our service, right? There are still churches around here that still have that idea. Yeah. And we've had a couple of ministers come into our church and say that, and they've been banned from our church. I am not making that up. Two ministers no longer allowed in our sanctuary because of some things like this. What? Yeah. We will not name names, but we can talk after. Okay. Another scripture talks about the fact that you get the idea of women are property because property can be damaged. And if you damage property, what do you have to do? You have to pay for it, okay? Damages have to be paid for. So we have in the book of Deuteronomy, for example, this. If a man meets a virgin who is not engaged, seizes her, lies with her, and they're caught, that's the proviso, they're caught, the man who lay with her shall give 50 shekels of silver to the young woman's father. Because? You've heard the term damaged goods. Yeah, damaged goods. Okay. Yeah. Her value to the family has been diminished. And so you would pay for that. What is that when your auto insurance, when you have a wreck and it devalues the car, what do you call that? Not accident forgiveness, but not. You guys are brutal. There's a term that not only can you get the damage fixed, but you can actually get extra money because that car has been in a wreck and that car will never have the same value again. Diminished value. Thank you. I was having a senior moment. Okay. Yes. That's a good question. Who knows what 50 shekels is? Was a shekel? I'm not sure. I used to know what a shekel was. One of those terms is a day's work. But I'm not sure if it's the shekel or not. So, good question. Research that for me, would you? Yeah. Ancient world, marriage was not understood the way we understand it. Romance had nothing to do with it. Being attracted had nothing to do with it. It's not about love. It's not about sentiment. It is a contract negotiated between two families, very often because families are seeking to put their family in a better situation. So if I can marry my child to the right person, that will enhance our family and the value of our family within the community. Now, some things have changed. We have a more enlightened view of women and marriage as a partnership. For example, in our wedding service, the father no longer gives, but he presents. Basically, he represents the family, but there's no giving. And you may know that the word obey has been removed from the vows. Can I have an amen? Okay. 1970s, there was a revision of the service that we've been using since essentially the 1500s. What's that?
We got married before then.
So she has... Good luck with that. That's right. How's that working out? Yeah. Yeah. Were you grandfathered in? Okay. All right. Having some fun here. But the basic idea that we're dealing with, the prohibition against breaking the marriage contract, the marriage covenant, it still continues to be a serious. A little later, we'll look at the language there. Now, the seventh commandment is on the second tablet, not the first, as we know. This is something we already know, but just for a moment, just kind of remember that. That gives it a very special kind of place because all the commands on the second tablet have this in common. They are, what do we need to preserve a community? What things, when they're violated, threaten the community? And this is one of them, you know. Basic idea, respecting, protecting others' marriage, then yours would be respected. And that is held to be an extremely high value. That we want to be in a covenantal community where that's respected both ways. In that way, the family's protected and enhanced, and ultimately, it is the community that reaps the benefits from that on all those. If you violate it, you threaten the community itself. And is that a big deal? Okay, it is a big deal. Many things could have been put in the second tablet. Only six made it, and it tells you that each of these six are considered to be utterly foundational to the community. Now, we fast forward to our time. We have a different view, and we live in a culture in which this kind of thing is kind of considered a private matter, right? Whose business is it? What would most people in our society say? It's a private matter. It's our own business. You know, you shouldn't be kind of mucking around that kind of thing. That idea biblically is utterly alien. There's no such thing as personal business or private business, or that we can do such a thing, do things in such a way that it does not have an impact on the community. It was a sort of the preface behind all this is that the community has value. In this culture, sex is not a casual act. It is not an activity. It has, and an interesting word, it has weight. We're going to look at the Hebrew of that because it's a very, very important word. It carries consequences. So, for example, maybe remember Hebrews, let marriage be held and honored by all. Let the marriage bed be kept undefiled. For God will judge fornicators and adulterers. What's the difference between those two terms? What's an adulterer? Yeah, within the marriage. It's a violation of the marriage covenant. Fornicator is sexual activity that is judged to be not good outside, does not involve married people. That is preserved in the scripture of marriage and the traditional service. And some of you, you're going to walk down memory lane. If you're old school with your marriage, you're going to remember this language. Do you remember marriage being an honorable estate? Okay, that's not in the contemporary service, but that's in the one that was there from 1500 on. That's actually biblical language. And there's an interesting word there, kabod. Not kebabs that you eat, but kabod. It means to give weight, significance, or importance to something. We honor something that has weight. Those are exactly the same in Hebrew. That which you honor is a weighty matter. If it's a weighty matter, we're called to honor it. They fit together. It's used in the commandment to honor your father and mother. We give weight and significance to our parents. We also call to honor our wedding vows and to give weight to those as well. So there's a very sort of close relationship here. Traditional wedding service affirms the marriage is weighty. It affirms, maybe remember this statement, this is the part the minister used to say, holy matrimony is an honorable estate. Remember those words? Instituted of God. It is therefore not to be entered into unadvisedly, but reverently, discreetly, in the fear of God. How many of y'all were married under those vows? Quite a few of us, yeah. It's changed. That's actually still in the book of worship, but that's not the one most people use. It's so honored and weighty that if you violate it, there's going to be consequences. And it's interesting that violating the commandment is seen as destroying the marriage. It's seen as destroying the family. It undermines the fabric of society. So Proverbs, we have this. He who commits adultery is an idiot. Literally, you know. He who does it destroys himself. It's seen as that kind of a view. Leviticus, it's interesting, the punishment for violating the marriage covenant is exactly the same as taking human life, which would be what? Death, okay. Chapter 20, verse 10. If a man commits adultery with the wife of his neighbor, both the adulterer and the adulteress shall be put to death. This is assuming that both are willing participants. You know, we don't have that law anymore, fortunately, but it's you get the idea there. It's considered very much. A marriage has as much value in Deuteronomic law as a human life does. So to take a human life is serious. To violate a marriage contract is serious. Like all the commandments, it puts a clear limit on human freedom. Our freedom ends where the rights of others begin. That's a principle, I guess, probably in all law, you know. We live in a society in which this kind of thinking is somewhat alien. You know, we tend to blur boundaries, live in shades of gray. But the culture back then was very, very different from that. Okay. Ten Commandments stand in stark contrast. Now, if you go to the Old Testament, you get some really interesting stories about this. Remember David and Bathsheba? Okay. It's a morality play. It plays out over about 9 or 10 chapters. You've got the story of David, who should have been at war because he was a king, right? And the writer is very critical of him. And when kings go out to war, David wasn't. He was looking at his deal, and Bathsheba's bathing next door on the next roof. It's told, the destructiveness with that in mind. So in chapter 11 of 2 Samuel, David commits adultery. And then for the next 8 chapters, what do you see? The devastating effects as it systematically destroys the family and results in the death of several people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it destroys family, yeah. But it's interesting, that story, and it's interesting that the key figure in the story is King David. That says something, you know. Says something not just about his character, but no one is above the law. That's what it says. Not even the king. Or Trump. Or anybody, you know. Yeah. We won't chase one of those rabbits, okay. Okay. One more insight that can be found in the traditional wedding vows. So let's look at another part of the vows. To have and to hold, remember this? From this day forward, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, to love and to cherish until we are parted by death, this is my solemn vow. That is still in the wedding service. That part of it did not actually change. Now, 2 things stand out about this. One, it is exclusive. Sometimes you get couples, they want to write their own vows, which that you can do that within limits, but I came to, there's about 3 things that you can't take out. God, because we're doing this in church, faithfulness, and the other one's the second, that it's lifelong. Okay, you know, it's not so long as it's convenient. And it's not, you're my most significant of several, you know, those kinds of things. You know. You would be surprised what we get asked sometimes, okay. Adultery violates both of those. It's faithfulness unto death. One of the striking things about the Old Testament, this is really true in the Old Testament and New Testament both, but what's striking is there's very few passages about this. I mean, it's put out there as a law, but there's very few places that it's actually dealt with. And it seems to be that one of the reasons for that is the 7th commandment is very straightforward. And it's not particularly controversial. There wasn't a lot of argument over what do you do with this one. It was like kind of self-evident, you know. You know what to do with that. Punishments are not as harsh, but the damages, as you mentioned, are just as real. Consequences are just as real. Now, we flip to the New Testament, we look at the ministry of Jesus. A couple of interesting things really stand out. The first is Jesus deals with this in very few places. There's almost no reference. There are some, but there's almost no references to Jesus teaching adultery. There are few, but very few. Most of these occur in lists where those things are self-evident. For example, you're going to find, I think, about 12 times in the New Testament this statement. You know the commandments. You shall not kill. You shall not commit adultery. Remember that? Matthew, Mark, Luke, Romans, another Paul's letters, James, and other places. That kind of thing gets you. It's like you should know this. It's not rocket science. It's not hard. It's not hard to comprehend. You know the commandments. You shouldn't kill. You shouldn't commit adultery. You shouldn't steal.
Okay, now there's a place where it says, you shall not kill. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it kind of, we talked about that last week. Kind of goes back and forth. Yeah. Even modern translations pop out one way or the other, or you could say you shall not kill illegally. Yeah, you shall not murder. But the point here is that adultery was thought to be self-evident. It's not. It's a no-brainer. You know, this is not something we need to talk about a lot. All the statements. Adultery is seen as one of those things that simply you don't have to do a lot of explaining because it said, you know that, you've been taught that. Now, what's interesting about Jesus' ministry, Jesus spends most of his ministry dealing with controversial topics. Susan?
What about all the multiple marriages?
Mm-hmm. Different issue, not covered adultery, because basically you could have, particularly in the patriarchal times, and even into early Roman times, you could have multiple marriage partners. That was not considered a violation. Slave, yeah. So all kinds of issues we're not chasing today. I want to get you out. We have a dinner in our house tonight at 5. Yeah, it just, but it's kind of like Pandora's box. There's a lot of things in there, yeah.
We're talking about Jewish law versus Roman law.
Yes. Yeah. You talking about Roman law? In the patriarchal times, you would have multiple wives, you could have concubines, you could have slaves, have children. Was that a violation of the adultery deal? And it was not held to be. You could have multiple marriage. The idea is if somebody is married to somebody else, and then you sleep with them, you break that covenant. The idea that multiples could be with you was not considered a violation in that culture. You could have a dozen wives, a dozen concubines, a dozen slaves, 50,000 children, you know, and there's some cultures where that's still, you know, not necessarily prohibited. The idea here is once you're in a marriage covenant, you don't violate that covenant. And again, it's gender laden. This is the guy having multiple wives, not a wife having multiple husbands kind of thing. So, yeah, a lot of equity issues there. Yes. Do not know. Somebody got a handle on that?
I don't, but can I ask you, in the vows it says, with death do you part. Now, the Mormons believe if you go to heaven, you're going to be with the same sibling, the spouse. Is there some, in the scripture, does it really say it limits it when you die? Or obviously, people are considered a widow,
There is one scripture where Jesus deals with that, and they try to trick Jesus when he goes to Jerusalem the last week, and they say, okay, let me tell you, there was this woman who was married, and he died. And the Levirate law, then the brother married her, and he died, and there's seven. And the question was, who will she belong to in heaven? And Jesus' answer is very enlightening. Idiots. That is not the way it is in the kingdom. Basically, we're not married. Basically, we're not given in marriage, that type of thing. So he's basically saying you're just chasing stuff that really does not matter. And as a context, they were trying to trick him, kind of. That's all I know of that we've got. Okay. Again, point is, it's not controversy; it's given. Now, second thing that stands out is that when Jesus does deal with it, he deals with it in very interesting ways. We're going to use two examples of this. Two times he deals with the issue of adultery, and it's not what you would expect according to Jewish tradition. So we just want to look at the two stories. The first is one, Matthew in the Sermon on the Mount. You've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. Okay? This lays it out. You know this, guys. By the way, he didn't bother to say it's wrong. Do you need to tell anybody it's wrong? You know it's wrong, okay? You heard it said, you shall not commit adultery. Now, I say to you, and he goes off in a way that we don't have any parallel to anywhere in the Old Testament. Everyone who looks at a woman lust, this is the famous Jimmy Carter verse, remember? Yeah. Carter got in trouble for this one. He had some splaining to do. Has already committed adultery with her in his heart. So for Jesus, adultery like murder is not, you know, is more than just the physical act. And that's one of the characteristics of that part of the Sermon on the Mount. There seems to be an attempt to get behind, well, prior to the act, what led there? What is the path that got you there? What underlies or leads to that act? Jesus does not say it's wrong or it's a sin. He didn't have to. That's just a given. Everybody agrees on that. You know. So he's going to explore kind of what's behind that. In the same passage, Jesus will then link adultery to the topic of divorce, and that is the conversation we're going to have in the fall when we get into the Sermon on the Mount, because that's probably about a 40-minute exploration even by itself. Second story is that wonderful story that's found in the Gospel of John that is not in the oldest manuscripts. Remember that? Chapter 8. The three oldest manuscripts of John do not have this in them. It's the story of the woman who was caught in adultery brought to Jesus by the Pharisees. Remember that? Fantastic story. So let's look at it. It's a little bit longer. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery. Now, we got a problem right there. Because we saw the Jewish law earlier. Who do you bring when they're caught? Both. All kinds of questions. Where's the man? Possibly he's already been stoned and killed. That's a possibility. Or a possibility is they don't care, they're just after her, because it says that what they really want to do is to trick Jesus. Making her stand before all of them, just, you know, to shame her, they said to him, Teacher, this woman was caught in the very act of committing adultery. Now, in the law of Moses commanded us to stone such women. What do you say? This is a trap because the law is clear. There's no ifs, ands, or buts here. The law is clear. So they want to trap him because they probably think he's going to not say what is traditional. They said this to test him so that they might have some charge to bring against him. Jesus bent down, wrote with his finger in the ground. Always want to know what he wrote. There's two times that we know Jesus wrote. Both of them are in this story. Okay. They kept questioning him. He straightened up and said to them, "Let anyone among you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." And one of the greatest verses follows this. Once again, he bent down and wrote in the ground. But you got to love this. When they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with, you know, when I'm 19, I can chunk a lot more rocks than I can approaching 70. You know, just the reality of life. Jesus was left alone with a woman standing before him. Jesus said to her, "Woman, where are they? Hasn't anyone condemned you?" And she said, "No one, sir." Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go your way. And from now on, do not sin again." Remarkable passage, particularly once you know the Jewish law in the background. Clearly, Jesus does not support adultery. Clearly, it is a sin. Clearly, it is condemned. But he does not condemn her. Some of that may have to do with the fact that it was only her, not the man. I mean, we're not sure. There's just a lot left there. You know, he doesn't focus on the punishment. Yes, it's a sin. There's no condemnation to her. There's no punishment belted out. He tells her, "Don't do it anymore. Do not violate it. Go and sin no more." And again, one of the unknown issues is, where is the man who was caught in the act? What is that? Jewish law clearly held they're equally accountable. Pharisees only bring the woman. And it looks like probably what that has to do is it's just simply to trap Jesus. So we got a little bit of time. Even with Barbara's deal, these are shorter messages. So you want to kick this around a little bit? Yes. That trend continues. It's even stronger in Europe. And when Barbara and I were in Australia and New Zealand, we found that there too. Less than 50% of the people bother to get married, and the number is dropping. And it's just, you know, it's just an interesting shift within the culture. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That number is even lower. Yeah. As Christians, we put the emphasis on the teaching of Jesus, and the teaching of Jesus, kind of across the board, is not a condemning. It's not a blanket's acceptance of sin, but he doesn't seem to have the harsh, judgmental tone. It's simply the call to not sin again, to change your life kind of thing. So yeah, and that's a very different tone from the law, the Old Testament law. The Old Testament law, you violate it, what happens? Yeah. Now, the interesting thing that rabbis say is, one of the real interesting questions is, how often was that actually done? And Jewish rabbis and scholars will say, the evidence indicates relatively infrequently, but it was there. It was there as a deterrent. Yeah, there's been a culture. It's interesting, for example, in the Methodist statement that we have on divorce, It's almost kind of a Jesus approach. Marriage is for life. It is exclusive. That is God's intent. But we live in a broken world in which marriages do fall apart, and in which, and our statement says this, that in some instances it is probably much healthier to get out of that relationship. Not that that was God's intent, but given the brokenness of the world and the brokenness of some of these situations, that type thing. So it's kind of the Jesus approach. Yeah, that's the standard. We don't waffle that when we do the marriage vows. That's the standard. But the reality is there are circumstances where that simply falls apart for infinite number of reasons, kind of thing. Yeah. The question in terms of young, I don't know the divorce, this would be an interesting statistic, I don't know if the divorce rate is any higher among the young. There's a significant number of people who divorce when the children leave home.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. They stay together for the children.
But it really hurts the kids, even
yeah.
if they're adults.
Yeah. It hurts all the parties.
My grandfather used to say that it was like a death.
Yeah. It is. It's the death of a relationship. It's the death of what could have been. It's the death of what you hoped it would be. Yeah. Yes. No, not that I know of.
What was the question?
The question was, are there any prophecies about Christ that might explain what he wrote there? If there's anything, it's most likely to be like 2nd, 3rd, 4th century A.D., because that was the period of time when people sort of filled in the gaps. There's stories about what Jesus was like as a child, what Mary was like growing up, stuff. They sort of fill in. Yeah, there's something there I've never heard it referred to, kind of thing. Okay. Barbara?
When it comes to women being recognized as something other than property, when did that start to happen in European or Western culture, and what, I guess, societal events or economic events precipitated that?
Yeah. My understanding, it's a pendulum that has swung back and forth. For example, Augustus Caesar in the Roman Empire gave rights to women. It's one of the big things he did. They could hold property, that gave them a lot of rights they had not had before. After Augustus, it kind of swung back again. I know during the period of Jesus seemed to embrace women in leadership roles, as did Paul. Later, it swung back in. Wesley was open to women. He reluctantly embraced that women could be clergy, that they could be ministers, that they could preach and all that. And during his life, the Methodist movement was known for women as leaders, as preachers, as evangelists. As soon as he died, the pendulum swung back. You would have the suffrage movement in the United States. And then, I know in 1954 is when the Methodist Church was the first major denomination to ordain women. The Pentecostals had done that earlier, because if you're Pentecostal, you follow the leadership of the Spirit. And the Spirit gives somebody the gift of preaching. Who are you to say no to the Spirit? So they embrace that first. But so in the 50s, so it seems to be a back and forth. The current swing that we're in, well, it's still being fought. It's issue in the news right now. But, you know, voting privileges. Barbara, there was a discussion the other day about when you were younger, when you could not, was something about property? Yeah, when you're married, your husband had to sign for a car stuff. You cannot have a bank account in your own name. Okay, this is in living memory of a lot of people. Yeah, yeah. And that's changed, but it was, yeah, there's a lot out there. Yeah.
That was 1967 when that law came into effect in Texas for women to have the right to own their own property.
So 1967, Texas passed the law that women could own their own property. That's a sobering thought.
It was a coin produced by the Phoenicians. It was
So 50 shekels would be a lot.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, my hunch would be that almost made like a dowry valuation. And I remember denarius was the one, as you said, denarius was, in the time of Jesus, a day's wage for the average laborer. So the shekel would be a much, much higher. Okay. All right. We got a little bit more time. One of the interesting things about that is that I think throughout the Roman period, marriage was not a religious rite. It was a secular, or not secular, but it was a state, something the state did. So I don't know the specifics of that, but the idea that we do marriages in churches now, and it's a religious ceremony, that's a later kind of development kind of thing. It used to be that was a function of the state, and it still is here. I mean, where do you get your license? Yeah, you got to go to the courthouse with that kind of thing. So, yes. Yeah, we've got some lawyers here. Might know is the common law marriage that many of us are raised with? If you signed that you were husband and wife, or if you lived together for a certain amount of time, you were, is that still valid? In Texas, it is. Okay, so it's a state by state thing. Yeah. Yeah. Because, what? Okay. That was a Spanish law that kind of got, kind of makes sense in Texas, wouldn't it? Yes.
Yeah, it's got two components. One, you have to live together, and two, intend to be married. And intent is shown by, like, if the guy puts her on his health insurance, or she represents at a party that they're married. The problem is, the way people live these days, they kind of white lie, oh, this is my spouse, but they don't want to be embarrassed or going on a trip together.
Going back to adultery, let me tell you what my grandfather used to say. When he just totally, there was no negotiation, he said, I'm agin it. Scripturally, adultery, we're agin it.